Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back to the Rational Face Podcast, the best podcast on the Blabbernacle. I am Brian Dillman, and today we have an excellent panel discussion on a very, I think for most, uncomfortable topic. For the last year or more since the Race and the Priesthood essay came out, race has become an important topic that shows up in Mormon discussions as well as in the wider culture. And, you know, personally, I often feel quite uncomfortable and I don't know how to deal with this topic very well. I feel out of my depth. And so today we have a panel to help people like me to kind of give us a racism 101 course. So please listen into this conversation. If you look at the show notes, there's a whole bunch of links, and in the body of the little blurb paragraph that I put there, there's a link in there to an article about white fragility. You'll want to read that article as soon as you're done listening to this podcast. But before we get in and keep talking more about that, let's jump right to the panel discussion. So, here we go. Well, we have a great panel here today to talk about, for me, a really uncomfortable subject. Recently, there's been some really bad stuff happen that's been in the news around race, and really for the last year and a half or so, that's been a topic that's come up periodically, especially since the church published the essay on race and the priesthood. And so we want to talk about this now and talk about what racism is, what forms it can take, and how we can talk about it better. And so I've got a couple people here. We have Mike Barker.
Good morning.
And it's been too long, but we do have Jerilyn Poole back on the podcast.
Hello, I'm here, barely.
She's awake. She just woke up, so don't give her grief. And Misha McGriggs, who's never been on the podcast, can you introduce yourself a little bit?
Sure. Thanks for having me. I'm Misha McGriggs. I am a PhD candidate at BYU. So getting toward the end of my academic career over there in counseling psychology. And I'm glad to be here. Talk about fun stuff.
Thank you. So there's this little clip from an episode of This American Life called Tribes, where they talked about different groups of people, but the intro to it, where the host talked with Jared Diamond, who's this sort of new historian / geographer, and I'm just going to play the clip right now.
There's a scientist at UCLA named Jared Diamond who came out recently with this book called The World Until Yesterday that's about how humans lived on this planet until about 10,000 years ago, when everybody lived literally in a tribe of a few hundred people or a small band of a few dozen people. And Jared Diamond writes this thing about life then, about what it means to actually live in a tribe that I had never heard before that really just stuck with me. He says that in these societies, because they were so small, you know, you knew everybody. You never encountered strangers. You know, you never ran into them.
The idea that you could just wander around and meet someone is utterly impossible. In New Guinea, if you ran across a strange person on your land, that could only mean that they were there for some bad reason. They were there to scout out your land for a raid, or to steal a woman, or to steal a pig. And so if you ran into a strange person in the forest and you couldn't run away from him, you came around a corner and there he was, then the two of you would sit down and you'd have a long conversation, which each of you names all your relatives, trying to find some relative in common which gives you a reason not to kill each other. And if after 2 hours you haven't found any relative in common, then one of you starts running or you try to kill the other person.
Diamond talked to me on the phone from Jakarta. He had just gotten there, back to electricity and showers after 3 weeks off the grid in Papua New Guinea. I wanted to speak with him because I wondered what he thought this story meant. Was he saying, okay, this is who we are. This is just built into us to be suspicious and fearful of outsiders, to want to stick to our own tribe?
It's going too far to do that. People can be more or less suspicious of strangers, and it depends upon the circumstance.
And so he says, for instance, the circumstances when humans lived in small traditional societies, there was good reason to fear strangers. Soon as human societies grew bigger into groups of thousands of people, you'd run into strangers all the time. It was normal. You wouldn't have these same reasons to fear strangers. And so we stopped in lots of places. Though, apropos of my conversation with David Brutus, Jared Diamond said that one of the things that does seem to have been true of traditional small societies 10,000 years ago that is still true today is an obsession with who's in and who's out, and seeing that people stick with the rules.
Whenever there's a group, you have the problem of figuring out who really is a member of your group and who is just pretending to be a member of your group for advantages. That may be part of the reason why humans have these very complicated cultures, including languages and body mutilation. If I come into a group and I say, I'm really a long-lost member of your group, but I can't speak your language and I haven't tattooed myself, then it'll immediately be obvious that I'm not a member of your group. So all groups have what are called expensive ways of identifying themselves honestly so that you can't just fake it.
Right. And the reason why it's so universal, is it just because if somebody can sneak in and be part of your group, then they're getting access to stuff that's really yours?
That's right. The term is freeloader.
And so it seems to me that we do have, there is at least some evolutionary logic to all human beings being very much aware of people that are in their group and people that are out of their group. And that might be from noticing differences in how they look and skin color, differences in how they behave, things like that. And so, you know, what do you think about that? Is racism evolutionarily true? Like, is that something that we come born with?
I think that depends on your definition of racism. As far as my understanding of the term racism, it has to do with power and privilege. And so right. An oppressed group cannot be racist toward an oppressor. Now, they can be prejudiced and they can discriminate, but they can't be racist toward them. However, my thesis on racism has always been that racism is a spectrum, that all of the oppressor, for lack of a better term, or white folks or the powerful group falls onto. And so I don't like the term that ends in an IST racist, because that turns it into a binary concept a dichotomous concept. And I just don't believe that that's accurate. I believe that, you know, everyone falls on this spectrum of racism, and it's about evaluating where we are and how we can move toward the end that would be, you know, less racist. So I think that depends on your you know, definition of the term, but I do think that either we all fall on it or, but I know it's not a binary. I think that's unfair.
And I've said for a while now that it's not something that people like, I'm a fan of the Seattle Seahawks. You know, it's not something that you just pick up one day. I think that's what offends so many people when they're accused of being racist, or that it's a system that we've grown up in that privileges white people over everyone else. So it's something we've been steeped in since birth. And this is a comparison I've made recently. It's like how we all grew up in grade school learning how to measure things with inches and feet and yards. When the metric system is better, but we've all learned a certain way. And it's not until we grow up and recognize that maybe there's a better way, aka the metric system, that we recognize that we've been doing something that's broken. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It also could be that you're not good at miles and feet.
No, I'm not. Do you see what I mean?
That's a good analogy.
If you're raised with a certain, learning, that becomes your default. And racism is the way we've been raised in America. White people are raised to oppress, and everyone else is raised to be oppressed.
Well, I have a question. Can I restate what I think you two are saying?
Yeah.
All right. So basically, everybody at some level is prejudiced. So, I mean, I'm white, so I carry prejudice. Misha, you're black. Okay, I'm half Latino and half white. So I'm my daughter actually.
Sorry, look at me. I just oppressed you, Mike. I just denied your ability to be fully white. Sorry.
Okay. I'm okay. I'm really confused about my race. Anyways, so everyone's prejudiced. So, Geraldine, you're prejudiced. Brian, you're prejudiced. You both are white. Me, I'm biracial. I'm prejudiced. And even Misha, who historically, because she's black, historically blacks have been oppressed, even she carries some prejudice, even though she comes from an oppressed group. Now, racism, from what I understand, only goes from top down. It's only something that those higher up, I'm not sure the right word to use, but those that are privileged are the only ones that can be racist then. Am I saying that right?
Correct.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. All right. So here's my other follow-up question then. So my daughters, especially my 9-year-old, doesn't comprehend how someone could hate someone else because of their skin color. And I don't think that's anything that Kathy and I have done spectacularly well. I actually think that my sense, and I want you guys to tell me where I'm wrong, my sense is that kids come kind of almost a blank slate. And so some of this is learned. And so where do you draw the distinction between where prejudice might be learned versus become kind of pre-wired that way versus, my daughter doesn't hate black people, but could she be harboring some type of racism because, she's mostly white and I'm not seeing it. So I kind of want to use my sweet, innocent 9-year-old daughter as a test case here, for you guys to kind of explain.
That's why I would lean toward systemic as opposed to evolutionary. In that, I don't believe that we're. I think that we're inherently able to. We're wired to be able to distinguish, right? Like to pick up on things very, very quickly. I mean, how do children acquire language, for instance, from a cognitive point of view? But I mean, that goes into their ability to absorb very quickly what's their environment around them. So hardwired to do that. To make distinctions and say, oh, that's different than what I'm experiencing or that looks different than me. I think that's there. But the systemic part of it is that we then, through our society, have been taught how to put a judgment on that distinction. And it does not take, they did the first I forget the study, but there's a study where they would put dolls in front of kids or pictures of people in front of kids. And at 4 and 5 years old, children were able to say black and white across the board, that the white dolls and the white images were what was beautiful. And the dark dolls and dark images were not as beautiful. So it does not really take very long for white children to become racist and for children of color to internalize that racism.
Do you think that's more of an issue of familiarity, or do you think it's fair to call it an issue of racism? Because from your earlier definition, racism is something that's used to oppress.
This is what I would say, Mike. If you look at, like, look at the, I just did this recent thing because I like to listen to television while I work, but I like to listen to television that doesn't, like, get me involved in it so that I can concentrate on my work. So I just recently re-watched or re-listened to the entire CSI series, which is like 14 seasons long or something like that. Yeah. And which is, I like it because it's scientific-ish and there's some, you know, there's, you know, some criminal stuff that's involved. And it's easy for me just to put it on in the background. But what I noticed as I was watching it is that is a show that heavily favors white people. It shows a lot of broken black bodies. And so even watching a show that you think, oh, you know, this, it's just television. It obviously skews to a very white audience. So even the media, and I'm not saying that your 9-year-old is watching a lot of CSI, but the media and the books that your children are watching and reading, that begins to skew their preferences. And that begins to skew the, who they prefer, right?
Okay.
So, and here, Mike and I live in Southern Oregon, which is, or you know, it wasn't very long ago that Oregon actually said no black people can live in Oregon. Oregon's a super racist state, and everyone would say, no, we're the Pacific Northwest. We love everybody. We smoke the hippie lettuce. But no, we're, like, this is still an area that's steeped in racism, and we don't see it because that's not our intention to be racist, but we live in it, so we absorb it. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, partially. Now,
no one wants to hear that their kid is being raised to be racist, but all of our children are being raised in America to be racist.
Yeah, yeah, no. I'm not. And I hope no one takes my questions as being like Fox Newsy. These are honest questions that where I'm trying
Sure.
check the borders here of what you're saying. Okay, is there a difference between my daughter, once again, preferencing someone that looks like her and being racist? My sense is it's the same thing, but I'm not sure if there's any nuance there at all, or if it's we're saying two different things to mean the exact same thing. Racist, yeah. And I'm preferencing white people.
I will absolutely defer to Misha in this, but this is, racism isn't just like having a Confederate flag and yelling racial slurs at people. It's just a system of privilege over somebody else and preference over somebody else. I mean, that definitely falls under the umbrella of racism, but racism isn't all hate. It's oppression.
Yeah, and I guess that goes back to what Misha was saying, that it's a continuum. It's not a binary.
Yeah.
Am I right, Misha?
Correct, yeah. I think that everyone should take the implicit bias test from Harvard.
Yes.
It's free to take, and basically it will show you who you have a bias toward or against. And it's very objective in that the way that the task is set up is such that it's able to pick up on those biases without you overtly stating them. It has to do with the timing that you click on your mouse and kind of tracking your movements as you're taking the task. And I think that is, to show, hey, look, we do have these biases. And so I would say that a preference or a bias would be, kind of a less severe, less potentially harmful form of racism, but racism nonetheless.
Yeah.
And obviously, lynching someone, that, is pretty overtly and violently racist.
Yeah, so that was kind of one of the things that I noticed when I've talked with family members and different people about this since the Race and the Priesthood essay, where they would say, I'm not racist because I'm not, like Geralyn said, waving a Confederate flag and being violent or verbally abusive. but there's this unspoken discrimination, and we'll have to get a link to that test.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Because that's been shown in all kinds of research about hiring people, police making judgments. Like it's just there. It's part of the. It's embedded in our psyche from our culture or from wherever, but it's definitely there that we have to actually take steps to remove the subconscious racism or subconscious prejudice, I suppose might be the more universally correct term, from those decisions.
And Brian, there's lots of people who will say, well, I've raised my children to not see color, which is also racist.
And racism.
I used to be so proud of the fact that when my kids were little that I never referred to my friends who are people of color as, you know, my black friend so-and-so or my, you know, I never referred to my friends that way. I always say, like, you know, my friend who comes over who, you know, and try and describe something else about them. And I was so proud of myself. I'm like, I'm teaching my children not to see race. But by doing that, I denied their humanity and
part of their identity.
Exactly.
Right?
And that was a hard lesson to learn and something that I've had to correct. So right there, I think, oh, I'm not racist. I don't see color. But it took me sitting back and listening to people of color say, oh, my gosh, I hate it when people say I've raised my children to not see color and to work through that defensiveness to realize I've done a terrible thing. So anyway, it's like I said, it's not, we're all not out there waving the Confederate flag. Sometimes we're doing things that we think are appropriate and right, but are wrong and racist.
Well, and even benevolent racism is problematic.
Exactly.
I mean, I've been told from the time that I was very young, and it happens all the time, that I'm so articulate. Okay, that's a compliment, but what you're saying in that, that's racist because you're saying, oh, you're so articulate as though I shouldn't be because I'm black. And so we're so shocked and surprised you can form a sentence. I mean, I've had it from people in academia. I've had it from people at church. I've had it from teachers. I've had it from, I was talking to a reporter at a news outlet and he said it to me, and I said, well, thank you, so are you. And, you know, so it's those types of things. When we say Asians are really smart, you know, or when we say, you know, well, black people can dance and can run fast, you know, these types of things, they sound like a compliment, but what you're doing is you're saying all of these people are like this. And that is implicitly racist. And frankly, it's exhausting when you get those types of microaggressions over and over again.
Do you understand? Yeah, microaggressions are important to talk about too. That's the unintentional racism.
Give a couple examples of microaggressions.
In my program, there's another black woman in the program. We don't look anything alike, like nothing alike. But the minute that I got into the program, I was her and she was me. And she would be called my name and I would be called her name. And and I would have to say, no, I'm Misha. I'm not that other student. And they would go, oh, and then some people say, well, maybe I need to see you side by side.
Good grief.
Yeah, okay, all right, let's do that because, yeah, we look nothing alike. But, oh, you know, we're both black and we're over work in this area. So, you know, to me, that's a microaggression. Or another one would be to say to someone who appears to be a foreigner, oh, your English is really good. And they're like, you know, well, you know, I was born in Denver or whatever, you know. So things like that are microaggressions. If you have any more, Geraldine, go ahead.
No, that reminded me of that video of the woman, the Asian woman, and the I believe it's another man. He's talking to her like, "Where are you from?" She's all, she's like, "Where are you from?" It's a very funny video, and it really points out like, especially our Asian microaggressions. In this country. I'll send you the link to that video too, Brian, to link it up. It's good. But yeah, microaggressions are just like, it's reinforcing stereotypes. It's the things that we say that reinforce stereotypes is what I would call microaggression.
I don't know if this is appropriate, but I'll plug that we did on Feminist Mormon Housewives podcast, a whole episode on microaggression. So if that's something you know, you want to learn more about, you can go there, and we had a great conversation about that.
Yeah, we'll definitely put that link up. Send me that.
Okay, great.
That episode, and we'll put it up. All right, so we've got these little things that we do where we automatically start lumping people together. That's a microaggression. So is the complimenting, you know, saying you're articulate or you're really good at basketball, is that also a microaggression, or is there a distinction into some other category?
I mean, it is a microaggression, and it falls along the distinction of benevolent racism.
Okay, right. Okay, so I think this is the important stuff to realize, that there are these little things that we do that we think we're being nice, or we think, you know, like Geralyn teaching her children not to notice or not to say the word black or African American or whatever it was, that we think we're doing something good, and that we're, you know, we get this sort of self-righteous confidence of look what a good liberal I am, or what a good person I am in general. And we're not doing any better than anyone else, really. I mean, we don't really need pats on the back for not using racial slurs, right?
Right.
Yeah, and, you know,
and Brian, I would say, I have done a lot of hard work on my own racism. I still consider myself a racist because I'm a white person. And once I just say this is something about myself that I am working on and I will never get right because of the country I've been raised in, because of the color of my skin. Once you can just say, look, I have a lot of internalized racism, I am working to eradicate it, it's so much easier. You just can't be defensive. White people have got to stop being defensive about the word. We've got to just own it and say, it's something we have to work on. So, and it's something I'm working on. I'm going to work on for the rest of my life.
Exactly. And I think it's the same thing with every privileged group. It seems like, and I've done this, the first thing you do as a man when you hear about feminism is you're like, hey, I'm not beating my wife, or I'm not being a jerk. You know, I'm a nice guy. I treat men and women the same. But that doesn't help anybody. That doesn't, you know, you have to recognize that you do think of people differently. Like when I went to graduate school, I had a female advisor, and I remember having this thought, like, it'd be okay to be with to have a female advisor, where I never would have had that thought. I never would have had the other thought, well, I guess it'd be all right to be with a male advisor. You know, these little things where I'm noticing it's taken me, you know, 33 years to figure out some of this stuff that is just, it's just in the way you think, and there's already these prejudices there, and recognizing it from the get-go is the first step. So then what is the next step? What are the other ways that you do the work, which I've heard in a couple of different places, you have to do the work. So what do you do to do the work?
Just really quick, though, I want to go back to where to that point. And I don't want to dismiss racism as, it's just a difficult path. No, it is insidious, and it is sinister, and it is ugly, absolutely ugly. And even though, you know, even though it's not something that we actively pursue, it is still something that oppresses millions and millions of people and absolutely destroys lives. So I don't ever want to dismiss race, even though I've said, like, well, you know, it's a system we've been raised in, and people, you know, racism. I never want to dismiss racism as just, it's just this difficult thing we're working through, too. Am I clear?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's different than, like, I need to get a work-life balance worked out.
Right. Because
it's a difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
That's not as pressing to you as dealing with your racism, and it's not as enormous as well.
Right.
Because it's not causing near the degree of harm, the amount of harm that
racism
is. Right,
because racism is what is behind what happened in Charleston. racism mm-hmm. is behind what has happened in, you know, all over McKinney, Baltimore. And I don't ever want to sit back and be like, it's benevolent racism. We're all, none of us mean to be racist, because it absolutely is an insidious, sinister, violent thing that millions of people deal with every day. So there you have it.
Yeah, obviously for our society, it's something that we've got to figure out so that we can be more connected, so that we can be more harmonious, so that we can have a better society. But, child, if you're trying to go to heaven, right, then this is something you've got to figure out.
Yeah.
I mean, that there's just no, to me, it's like, yeah, it impacts this earth right now for all of us, right? But for those who are attempting to get, you know, through the pearly gates, I think that this is going to be, you know, one of the things that is inquired of, you know, how did you love? How did you treat my children? And that's with regards to race and gender and sexuality and religion and all, you know, facets. It's how did you treat my children? So it's very serious. And I think a lot of people think they go into heaven and it's not going to be cute when they get there. So, yeah, we want to help you figure it out so you can go. I want you there. I want
to. Misha just wrote this really great op-ed for the Salt Lake Tribune. I think it came out today, right?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, it was online yesterday. It talked about what it means to be black in the Mormon Church, which is another form of you know, this sort of benevolent racism. Well, I hate to say the word benevolent when we talk about racism in the Mormon Church, but also, you know, is a huge problem in the Mormon Church. Anyway, it's a great op-ed, and you should link to it in the comments or in the post.
Yeah, I read it. I read it this morning. Misha forwarded it to us. It was good.
Oh, good.
So yeah. I have a few questions. So yesterday, Gerilyn forwarded me the Mormon Newsroom thing about how the church bought copies of the records. The Freedmen's Bureau. Thanks. I was going to say Bureau first, and I know there's another word there. Freedmen's Bureau. And anyways, so I'm watching it with my daughter, my 13-year-old daughter, and immediately the thing I noticed was that the person leading the meeting was a black man, that all the black people that spoke weren't speaking, from my standpoint, weren't speaking because they were black, but they were speaking because of what they had done professionally. And yes, they were black. And is me noticing that, am I noticing that because because of some type of prejudice that, look, it's great to see these black people up front talking, and then actually Elder Christofferson looks like the token white guy in this instance to me. He, you know, as my wife put it, he looked like he got photoshopped in there, you know. So, you know, to me, in my mind, it's different than saying, oh, how nice they have a black person mixed with all these white people. In my mind, it was different. In my mind, I was like, we have all these professional black people that have made a name for themselves in their own professions, and they are speaking about this, I think, great thing, great step forward that the church has made.
So I think that the way you conceptualize it is absolutely because of your perspective, and the way I conceptualize it is very different.
Okay, I want to hear what you say.
So the way that conceptualize it is absolutely Elder Christofferson is the one in charge in that meeting. There's no doubt. The church bought, the church paid for copies of those records. So the church is really in charge of this project. They are the financial backers of this project. And Elder Christofferson is there as a representative of the church. The person leading the meeting is a stake president who was a bishop at the time of the movie Meet the Mormons. I think it is absolutely... I don't want to sound like it's I don't want to say calculated, but I think that it was planned to have a man who has a impeccable kind of trajectory in the church who has an audience and a following because of Meet the Mormons and who is black. I think that it was the fact that they asked him to lead the meeting. I don't know. He could be very involved in the project, or he could not be involved in. We have no idea at this point because he does not work for any of the organizations that were represented there. He's an education and like a public school principal or something like that. He and his wife were both co-leading the meeting. I thought that there was other people talking who were from the organizations. Now those people have built. Resumes of their own because of their work. Absolutely. They weren't just there because they're black. But the person from the name of the company?
Family Search,
who was owned by the church. This man, this black man, I think it was like Tom Reed or something like that, his name. He said that he's a novice genealogist and he works in marketing for that company, which is owned by the church. I do not think that he is in the role of marketing this new project. But I think that I think that he was asked, right, to be involved in this project, likely because of that he's black. And I mean, there's some speculation in that. But I mean, just the questions that I have, right, and the way that I conceptualize it is different. And I don't think that – I think that that is – and that's a difference between the way that white folks would conceptualize what was going on that stage and how I conceptualized what was going on that stage. And again, there's black people who have conceptualized completely differently. And so I don't want to speak for everybody, but for me, I felt that it was, there were definitely some planned out moves for who would talk and communicate this message. So yeah, I hope that doesn't ruffle any feathers too much.
No, it's an excellent perspective, and I do want to say that Brother Sullivan and Brother Reed both are people that sort of swim in our progressive Mormon waters too. So I have high hopes for them.
And I will say that project, I think it's beautiful.
It is beautiful.
The project, because it's painful. It's an open wound in the black community to not be able to know your family, to have your identity stripped from you, to be able to not connect any of those family ties. And so I think it is the project for the black community. I think it's going to be huge, and I think it's beautiful. My concern again is the church owning copies and the church having perhaps a different plan for those names.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that I don't know if that creeps into the mind of a lot of people. But
yeah. I thought it was beautiful that they released it on Juneteenth, paying an homage to that African American holiday, which I guarantee 98% of white Mormons had never heard of before, and did some Googling, and
guilty.
I thought.
Yeah. Thanks for pointing that out.
But I felt like the church handled a lot of that really beautifully and really well. And granted, there were some huge blind spots. That maybe not all white people saw. I didn't see them myself. And but I still. Anyway, I feel like I'm an apologist right now, which is all right. I'll own it.
Well, I don't want to come down too hard, on it either. There were just little things that I picked up on. And those things are, and some of that is maybe a personal projection, and some of it isn't. I don't know. Tom Reed saying that he was glad that this event was able to bring historic meaning to this day. Like, that line to me, I thought... Oh, honey, no. This project doesn't make this day historic. Like, Juneteenth is historic because that's the day that we were emancipated, boo. Like, just like that. Just little things that I pick up on.
Know your history. Yeah.
Yeah, and so, yeah, I don't know. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, that makes sense. Nope, that makes sense.
So I think for one, conversations like this, where we can talk about, you know, without feeling personally threatened for not getting it right and learning, I think these are important steps. I think hearing different views or analyses of like this Juneteenth event, Mike's perspective and then Misha's perspective, I think those are valuable in seeing, at least recognizing racism. But what are the other things that I asked a little while ago, and then we got on this other boat for a bit.
Right.
What are the other things that we can do to do the work? What are the next steps? Like, along with taking the, what was that test called?
Implicit bias test. Doing the work is really about deconstructing your privilege. And so I think the first step is we've covered is just owning the term racist and not having a lot of guilt associated with it, in that it's not an either or. It's not I'm either a racist or I'm not. But I'm working and I'm here and I'm working. And so that's, to me, that's the first thing, is accepting that. There's actually academic work that talks about, let me get the exact name of it. So it's white racial identity ego statuses and Helms information processing strategies. And basically what that is so when we talk about racial identity development, people think, well, is that a white thing? So that doesn't seem like a white, you know, issue, racial identity development, but this would be that form of racial identity development. So it's white racial identity ego statuses. And basically it runs through like these different areas where you are in basically your privilege. And so it's first you're kind of oblivious to it. And then something brings it to your awareness. And then you start to kind of work through that by reading and by going to multicultural training, different activities, and by showing up and by listening. And those are the types of things that really help you to deconstruct that privilege and reconstruct a new identity for yourself. One that still acknowledges your racism, but one that then puts you in the space of an ally. And I think Geralyn can speak more to this, because I consider, as far as race goes, Geralyn to be one of the best allies that we have in the Mormon progressive community. Oh, take it away, ally. I do.
It's true.
Woo.
I know, right? Ooh, I just got my cookie.
but you didn't speak it. I just threw it on my own. But you can eat it up.
Well, I think some of the things that I've done to deconstruct racism in myself, and like I say, it's a lifelong thing. I do not have it. Is to be prepared to be wrong a lot of the time, and if you feel yourself getting defensive, to lean into that and figure out why you're defensive, and where you need to correct, where you need to come correct, because you're not being defensive because you're right. So, and absolutely change up what you're reading, what you're watching on television, what you're listening to. Change it up. Get the perspective and the lives of people of color into your consumptions, so that you learn more about of what's outside of yourself. So there's some really great television shows on right now, Blackish. Which is also, it's a show that's steeped in some privilege, because but it's got some great themes in there about what it's like to be a black person in America, and it's a great perspective. There's Fresh Off the Boat, which is another show about what it's like to be an Asian American. Empire is another show that's got a hugely black cast. Which is another way, which is another great show. I think the things that we do to eradicate racism in ourselves is to see oppressed people with new eyes and see their humanity.
Absolutely. I think that watching the media and seeing how do we conceptualize those things, I think that right now with what's happening with Mother Emanuel is, you know, many people who have not deconstructed their privilege in the media are talking about that this was an attack on Christianity, or this is about Christians being killed. And it's like, okay, well, when you have a witness who survived that said, the shooter said, I want to kill black people, and you still have people saying this is about Christianity because they went to a Christian church. No, he didn't go to he went to a black church. He went to a historically black church. If you went and shot up a Jewish synagogue, people would say, well, this is a hate crime against Jews. If you went to a Hindu temple, which they never bother people, so no one would shoot up a Hindu temple. But if someone did shoot up a Hindu temple in America, you would say, oh, that's a hate crime against, you know, Indian people and Hindu people. But when a historically black church, which is completely separate from, their white counterparts, completely separate from the white counterparts, which is understanding the history of the black church in America, it's very easy to see that this is about a racially fueled white supremacist act of terrorism, is what it really is. And so when you say things like, well, I don't know if it's about race or if he was just crazy or all of that, those things are racist to say.
Yeah.
They diminish what's
you gotta
really
pay, you got to pay attention to who's saying that. So it's white people saying, it's not racist, right?
You know, and with the mental illness
thing,
he hasn't been evaluated by anyone. And at the same time, when you say, well, he was mentally ill, it's like, well, I guess anyone taking Prozac, we should be aware of, and we should put a label on him because they're dangerous.
We don't want to excuse,
which is not true.
We don't want to excuse his what the violence of what's happened to people, right?
Mm-hmm.
We also when we dismiss things under the umbrella of mentally ill, that's a microaggression against people who struggle with mental disorders.
Right.
Yeah. Right?
That's highly offensive to me as a mental health practitioner, like as a clinician. That's highly offensive to me because what we know is that people with severe mental illnesses are actually more likely to be the victims of violent crimes. And
right.
They're not the typical perpetrator of violent crimes. Most people who have been found to murders and killings and all these things, those people, the majority of them are not mentally, have been found competent and not mentally ill.
Right.
So we perpetuate stereotypes against all of these different marginalized groups to help us feel justified in our prejudice. That's not helping anybody, you know?
Right. Right.
Yeah. I think this is where, you know, a while ago words like contempt, we've had Jennifer Finlayson Fife on a lot, and she talks about men having contempt for women or white people having contempt for black people. And it didn't make sense to me for a long time because I don't consciously choose to be angry or contemptful towards different groups. But this kind of behavior, this self-protective behavior, is it's coming out of a place of fear that you're wrong or that your privileged status is doing bad things, and so you're angry internally at these people that might be challenging that. And that's something that needs to be recognized as well, that it's, you know, you're not just trying to get to the bottom of this and try and find the real cause. You're simply, you know, deflecting and trying to protect yourself, typically.
Yeah, right. If you just operate from the standpoint that you are always wrong and ready to
when
be corrected, that works out a lot better for you, I have found.
Okay, so I have one more question or topic. Which is kind of specific to a podcaster having panel discussions, but also to just groups of people having a conversation. And, you know, if you're sensitive to these issues, you want to do it right. But like Geraldine has pointed out, we often do it wrong. And so, for instance, if you're going to talk about gender, you feel this compulsion, like you can't just be a bunch of dudes talking about gender inequality, or you can't just be a bunch of straight people talking about LGBT issues, or you just can't be a bunch of white people talking about racism. So how does it – it's this conundrum of like, oh, we need someone's perspective from the other side so that we don't get this wrong. But are you just pulling this person in as a token? Are you pulling this person in just by virtue of them being black, being a woman, being gay, or whatever the case may be? You know, how do you balance this out? Like, is it possible to have conversations among a closed group about other groups that are actually productive? And is it wrong to pull someone in from the minority group or the oppressed group by virtue of them being part of that group? Like, how does that all work out? Because this is something I feel guilty back and forth about the way we do things all the time.
Well, first, when we're talking about if we're going to talk about race, when you asked me the other day if I'd be interested in being on a podcast about race, I said yes. But if we're going to talk about race, we need to have the perspective of a person of color. And let me ask Misha, who's my very dear friend, if she would be interested.
Right, is our relationship.
Right, because our relationship isn't about, like, I don't just go to her for race issues. I go to Misha for lots of things, and our relationship is deep and richer than that. And because I also listen up and pay attention when she talks about race issues. And I also recognize that Misha's not the only person of color. Like, her opinion on race issues is her opinion. I don't now go and say, well, Misha says this. I have, you know, I sit at the feet of many people of color and learn perspectives. My relationship with Misha is such that I can ask her to participate in a podcast on race because that's our relationship. And she doesn't feel tokenized because she knows it comes from, well, I'm making assumptions, but so it's one thing to ask people to be, you know, you don't want to ask someone to educate you because your education is your own responsibility. But so you want to invest in somebody, you want to read what they're writing, you want to hear the conversations that they're having and learn from that in a way that doesn't put the pressure on them to educate you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so what about not educating but checking your answers? You've come to these conclusions. You're like, okay, well, so what do you think? Am I still messed up or
Ryan,
am I on
so
track?
It's like you and I have a friendship, and I have come to, you know, I've said to you point blank, when you have questions about feminist issues, me as a woman, come talk to me about them. Like, I'm opening myself up to that for you because we have this relationship where I trust you to treat me equally, right? And I think
But I shouldn't just email someone else and say, hey, you're a feminist. Come talk
right,
to me about this.
Right,
is that what you're saying?
Right, yeah. But okay. Also, I can't speak for all feminists, so I can only speak to my own perspective. And Misha's opened herself up to talk about race. I mean, she wrote this op-ed. She's written several articles lately on the FemWalk blog and FFH about race. She's maybe open to talking about it in a way that maybe some other people of color aren't open right now. It all comes down to relationships.
Okay. I think that's a great point of advice.
Yeah. I have some personal experience of doing it wrong. And so let me share that with you guys. I see the predicament that you're bringing up, Brian, because I think there needs to be discussion among what is called allies now, you know, amongst ourselves. So if you're a male feminist ally, dudes need to talk about this amongst ourselves and educate ourselves among ourselves without always,
But use the words of women to educate yourself. Don't just be like, well, this is what feminism means. Har, 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 penis. Like, sorry. Can I use that word on your podcast?
You can say penis and vagina. So you could get like an essay from a feminist book or something like that.
Get lots of perspectives.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So don't just be a bunch of guys sitting there. So let's talk about women. Right?
Yeah.
That happens often enough.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
But okay. Then that's also the same thing with race. So white people, we're having a conversation about race, but hopefully we're going to bring in, we're bringing in the perspective of people of color, but also we're going to be doing the work, which is reading, listening, understanding the perspectives of people of color, instead of just saying, well, I'm a white person, so I obviously have it right. Right?
Yeah. No, I agree. So here's where I have messed up. So I'll have questions, and I'll ask like Janan or LaShawn. Actually, I'll ask like Alf. Janan, LaShawn, I have lots of conversations with, as well as Fatima, and then Fatima's sister Najee. I'll be asking questions, sincere questions, but there becomes a point where you can tell they've just got exhausted with me. And I'm like, oh. And at first I'm like, did I say something wrong? And then, no, it's dawned on me that they're like, dude, you gotta do some reading, man. You know, you can't always come, we can't be your only source for this. Because I imagine, and correct me if I'm off base here, Misha, that it gets exhausting for a black person to be the only one educating a white person about racism. Am I off with how my perspective? So that's kind of, go ahead.
Yeah, it does. And I think that different people have different levels of, they have different capacities, wind capacities, right? Or lung capacities for that type of thing. I would say mine's a little longer than some people's, and so I think that's a product of the fact that I was raised in a white family and in white suburbia in a white church, and so that has been my experience from the time that I was very small is interacting with white people, and that's not the case for everyone else, and so people's tolerance is different, and so I think, but. At the basis, I think it's important as a principle to understand that it is not the responsibility of the oppressed to educate the oppressor about their oppression. And so when there are formal events that are going on, attend. Sunstone had a Borderlands Theology from the Margins that, I had a great attendance, and I think those people got a lot out of that experience. But how many more of those people didn't show up that are in town or were able to go? And so it's things like that. Like if you want to, to really get this stuff and to become a good ally, then take advantage of opportunities to where people are saying, I'm here and I want to teach you, as opposed to, just the random text when you feel like engaging in the conversation. Because I don't get an opportunity to say, no, I'm going to not engage with being black and woman anymore. Like, I don't get it. I don't get to do that. I think doing your homework is super, super important on your own. And then building relationships with people and knowing, kind of checking it out with them. It's individual, but, it's so that sounds more complicated than it really is. I'm making it sound really like a lot of complicated work, and I don't want people to get exhausted and be like, okay, I'm checking out. That sounds like too much. That just sounds like too much.
Oh, no. Yeah, and to be honest with you, there have been times over the past couple of months where I'm like, what I'm going to do with racism? I'm just not going to talk about race for a while because I'm just getting it wrong like all the time, and I don't know what I'm doing wrong. And so initially it was actually like I don't want to do it because – I don't want to look like an idiot, right? But over the past, little while, it's more like I don't want to do it because I don't want to hurt someone's feelings, which I think is a little bit better view, but still I should just be willing to find time to do the hard work.
Dude, if you're afraid of hurting somebody's feelings, then you got to be prepared to apologize. That's all it comes down to. Like, yeah, I'm going to make mistakes, but I absolutely will apologize and come correct. That goes a huge long way.
And the person that you have a relationship with, right? Like, you already have an established relationship with this person.
Yeah.
They might have their feelings hurt, but they're probably going to be receptive to your humility at the same time because you do have that relationship and they want to preserve that.
To fix things. This is hard work. Yeah.
It is hard work.
It is. And it's hard work. And what I think happens a lot of time is that people, as I go into my therapist mode here, that people feel shame is never a feeling that is going to help you be productive. Mm-hmm. Shame keeps you trapped and keeps you stuck. Now, I think that there's something to guilt, and I think that they're two different emotions, shame and guilt. And guilt, that says that I did something bad. That says that I did something that wasn't gracious, and so I'm going to make amends for what I did wrong. Shame says, I'm bad, I'm wrong, I'm a horrible person, look at how bad I am, of course I did a horrible thing. And so I think a lot of people, as they start out on this journey, they start feeling this shame and this self-loathing, and that does not help you, and that does not help you do this work to deconstruct. And so I think if we can shift to that guilt feeling of like, ooh, maybe that wasn't so hot, that wasn't so good, okay, all right, I can acknowledge that, and then I can go and still make amends and move forward. That's what we're aiming for. And when that happens, it's so appreciated. And I know sometimes that that folks can be hard on those who are starting out on this journey or anywhere on this journey. We can be tough, right? And I think that's because we've had to be tough to survive. And so we can come across as tough. And so I say, put on your big boy pants and get your skin right, and thick, because you are going to get beat up a little bit along the way. But when you come back and you make the amends and you're trying, from me, it is so appreciated. I know from others too, it's really appreciated, because I don't particularly think we need you, but I want you. I want you on the journey with me. It's the more voices that we have, the better the community is, the more listening ears and the more voices that we have. So it's appreciated coming, from me anyway.
A year ago, I had a conversation with my friend Trina Nelson Thomas, and she was telling me, she's like, you talk about race, but you've got to be more bold. And I was like, oh, but I get it so wrong. And she says, but you're talking about it. And that was something that stayed with me. Like, talk about it. Be prepared to be wrong. Come correct when you are wrong. But talk about it and bring it up. And so that's why a lot of my feed on Facebook and a lot of my conversations in real life center around issues of race, issues of sexuality. I'm trying to talk about these the people in my life who are marginalized. And I have to be bold about it. I do get it wrong a lot of the time, but an apology goes a long way when you're willing to have the conversations.
Mm-hmm. Really does.
Yeah. So don't be afraid to be wrong. Only be afraid to not be talking about it.
Yep.
Well, I think this has been a good discussion. There's a lot of things that have been clarified for me, especially that I need to do more work on my own. But I want to thank all of you for coming on and talk about this, Jerilyn, being an example of how to do this more proactively, talk about race more in a better way as a white person. Misha, for teaching us more and clarifying a lot of things that I was confused about, and Mike for bumbling along like me. So thanks for coming on, everyone.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
All right. right. So I hope that discussion was useful. I hope some of your perspective has been represented in the discussion, and I hope that you were made uncomfortable or that your thoughts were provoked in some way during that discussion. I think that all people that listen to this podcast, and most if not all that read the blog, are sensitive to issues of race. We're all concerned about being kind to other people, being fair. We don't want to be racist. But I also think that the majority of the people that read this blog, and meaning at least 51%, I'm not saying 99, are also like myself in that they haven't invested a lot in terms of reading academic literature or even popular literature in really trying to get the perspective of someone in a minority status, like someone that's black in the United States. And this article on white fragility that I mentioned in the beginning is an excellent introduction to those sort of things. I read it as I was editing this podcast, and I was surprised how many assumptions. I felt like I was coming in to the discussion somewhat well-informed, someone that really isn't, at least not overtly racist and doesn't have racist thoughts or racist ideas. And as I read that article, I realized how many of those things are true for our white culture in the United States and for myself. And the way that I feel about the topic of race, which is not, it's not something I've written about, it's not something that I've done podcasts about, because it is something that I don't have to deal with as a white person. But after this conversation, after that reading the article, I'm realizing that this is something very important, and it's sad that it's taken tragedies to get people like me to stand up and listen up and think about it. So all of you that are listening, before you go on and read your next blog, before you move on to whatever book you're reading, look at that article. Read the whole thing. It's like 2,000 words. It would take you 10 minutes to read the thing. Read the article. Let it sink in, and let's move forward. Let's keep having these kind of conversations. Let's learn how to talk about things in a good way, and let's see if over time we can't beat this thing and become better people, become a little bit less racist. So I leave that challenge with you, and as always, please keep keeping it weird.